Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Abrams has been working on voting issues for decades. She is the former minority leader of the Georgia House of Representatives, and in 2018, she became the first black woman nominated by a major party to run for governor, but it was an election that was overseen by her opponent, who won, sort of. Since then, she's founded Fair Fight, which works to prevent voter suppression tactics, and Fair Count, which focuses on an accurate count in the Georgia census so that redistricting can happen fairly and money for critical services can get to the people who need them the most. Stacey Abrams was on the show in June to talk about her book, Our Time Is Now, in which she shows how the right to vote and the principle of democracy are still under attack in three ways: voter registration, limiting access to the ballot, and ballot counting and rejection. Abrams got her start as an adult in voter registration work in 1992 after the Rodney King incident. But she was actually involved in activism her whole life.
And actually, I'll push it back a little bit more. I actually started doing voter registration as soon as I was still 17 when I got to Spelman College. I think it became more, there was greater exigency because of the Rodney King protest. Mm-hmm. But I'd grown up in a family that had been a part of the civil rights movement. My mom and dad were both very active as teenagers. My dad was arrested at the age of 14 for registering people to vote, black people to vote in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And so I was probably the most nerdy 18-year-old. The day I turned 18, the thing I was most excited about was getting to register to vote. And I then started trying to, before and after, tried to register students at Spelman and Morehouse. The reason for that was that, particularly in the wake of the Rodney King protest, I understood the very deep connection between the policies that were ginning up police brutality, but also youth poverty, and how it connected to the city of Atlanta. What I think we forget is that this protest happened at the same time as a presidential election. And for me, part of the responsibility was to ensure that my fellow students were actively engaged in that election, because I understood that policymaking was one of the only real long-term solutions to the challenges we saw.
What is a problem from that time in terms of voter registration that persists today?
Voter registration in 1992 was a much simpler issue because we had the protections of the Voting Rights Act in the South. I grew up in Mississippi. I came of age in Georgia. I went to college there. I went to grad school in Texas. And in each of those spaces in 1992 through 2013, the Voting Rights Act provided protection. It said that you could not, as a state, take action that would limit access to the right to vote. You had to get it pre-cleared. And under both Democratic and Republican administrations, the Department of Justice was fairly aggressive about pushing back against limits. What happened in 2013 was that the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act and said that these bad actor states that had started to inch back towards bad behavior after the election of Barack Obama, that they had carte blanche to do what they wanted. And that meant that you saw increasing restrictions on access to the right to vote. In Georgia in particular, you saw the use of the exact match system, which in 2009, then Secretary of State Karen Handel was told was going to be racially discriminatory and should not be used. But in the wake of the evisceration of Section 5, then Secretary of State Brian Kemp brought it back. And in 2018, 53,000 people were held hostage by the system, meaning that their registrations were not processed, often because of typographical errors that were disproportionately affecting people of color. 80% of people of color, so 80% of the 53,000 were people of color, 70% were African American. But the reason this matters so much is that the caution was that the spelling, the use of punctuation, mm-hmm. the difference in the names when you went beyond the normative Anglo-Saxon naming traditions, that would mean that communities of color would be most likely to have someone make a mistake. And it proved to be true.
What's an example of an egregious exact match that you saw that you thought this is ridiculous?
So the example that we use, there's a gentleman who was Hispanic, and his last name had a space in between it, so Del and Rios. That space is not permitted by the Department of Motor. We call it the DDS, the Department of Driver Services, but it's what everyone else knows as a DMV. That space, in the example I use, that space between Del and Rios, when you type it in, if you put the space that his birth certificate has on it in Georgia's system, it will not recognize that space. And so because it does not exactly match the database that the state is using, he is now rejected and not permitted to register to vote. But what was more problematic is that the problem is never explained. You're just told your registration has not been processed. You're not told why.
The second issue you talk about, we could go on about voter registration for a while, but I want to make sure we touch each point, is limiting access to the ballot. And there are so many different ways that this can be done. And the one I want to point to first is one that's anecdotal, but I think it's powerful, and it's the story of your grandmother who had the opportunity to vote in 68 in Mississippi, but she said she was too scared. She told your grandfather she was afraid of the dogs and the police. And you write in your book, voter suppression works its might by first tripping and causing to stumble the unwanted voter, then by convincing those who see the obstacle course to forfeit the race without even starting the run. How do you combat things like fear? I mean, I think when we think about combating sort of tangible things, but something as powerful as fear.
Fear is most effectively combated when people understand and can deconstruct what they're afraid of. And that was the reason for writing the book. We hear I talk about voter suppression, but people don't know what it means. They think, well, voter suppression is what they saw, what my grandmother was afraid of in 68. She was remembering very, very recent behavior that had existed through 65, even through 66. But what we're talking about today is a much more subtle form of discrimination. It is this labyrinth of rules. And so one example of limiting access to the ballot is the closure of precincts. When you shut down a polling place, it may seem innocuous to someone who has a car and a flexible job. But if you're someone who relies on one bus route to get you where you need to be and to drop you off to vote before you have to get to your second shift job, the moving of that polling place can mean the elimination of your right to vote. Because not every state has early voting. Not every state allows you to vote by mail. And so if your only opportunity to vote is the day of, and your only window of opportunity is an hour or two because you live in a state that doesn't pay you when you take time off to vote. Federal law says you get time to vote. It does not say you have to be compensated. Then you have to make rent that week. You may not be able to wait in line for 8 hours, and you may not be able to get to a polling place that's been moved across town where your bus doesn't go. And that affects millions of Americans. We saw in February in Texas, the closure of more than 400 precincts led to 6 to 8 hour lines, primarily in Black and brown communities.
How do you fight the fatigue? If someone just heard that, and they, even though they really want to vote, but they fall into all those categories you mentioned, how do you fight the fatigue to stop fighting?
One is that you have to know that you're not in it alone. One of the most insidious parts of voter suppression is, so one piece is that we don't know what it is, or we can't articulate it, but the second is that it looks like user error. We have been convinced by these deceptively logical arguments that, well, if you were just willing to do your part, it would work. And I become so aggravated when I see this dismissive behavior when it comes to restrictive voter ID, for example. Restrictive voter ID is not that you don't have identification, because actually every state has always required some form of ID, but it's when you limit the forms of ID that are permitted and you put in place restrictions that winnow out and weed out people who otherwise would legitimately be able to cast a ballot. So to the point of fatigue, we get fatigued because we don't think there's a solution. And the second half of our time is now is all about what solutions look like. But one of the most effective ways to beat fatigue is to gin up legitimate outrage. I need people to be angry about this. I need them to say, this is not right, and I'm going to fight back. I am not going to let myself be defeated by your iniquities, I am going to fight back and ensure that my right to vote, that our right to vote, is not impeded by bad actors.
My guest is Stacey Abrams. The name of her new book is Our Time Is Now. And the third point you make is we need to reform the act of ballot counting and rejection. So the issues around ballot counting, I think people understand, machine malfunctions, incompetence. But what about ballot rejection is particularly troubling to you?
So let's think about what that means. It means you've crossed all of these other hurdles and you've gotten to the finish line, but because of some flaw in the administrative rules, they've decided your vote doesn't count, even though you have proven that you have the right to vote. You've taken the steps of actually casting the ballot. But at the very last minute, at the finish line, they say, oops, never mind. We know that absentee ballots are twice as likely to be rejected if they're cast by Black and Brown folks, five times more likely to be rejected if they're cast by young people. We know that part of the decision making is this ersatz notion of signature match. Signature match is when they look at how you sign your absentee ballot envelope and the signature they have on file. Well, signatures change. It is junk science to say that a layperson can determine the accuracy of a signature. Signatures change based on whether you're using a pen or a pencil or a stylus, whether you're writing on paper that is thick or paper that's thin. I point out that my signature changes from CVS to Kroger because they use different pads for how I sign things. And yet it's been used as a justification for rejecting ballots. And what's even more offensive is that if you are Black or Brown or a young person, you are less likely to be told, we think there's something wrong, can you come and fix it? If you're white, they will likely notify you so that you can remedy the challenge. But if you're in those other categories, the presumption is that you don't have the right to vote. And that presumption is often made based on where you live, what your zip code is, and whether they think your signature is close enough. We should not be able to reject a person's vote unless there is an affirmative proof that that vote should not count.
For people who, those who like the way things are, and I don't think anybody's gonna walk around saying they're pro voter suppression, but they're okay with the way things are, what is their Achilles heel?
When you break the machinery of democracy, it breaks for everyone. If you look at what happened in Georgia last Tuesday, in my world, I was not surprised by the calamity, but I was very much surprised by the scale so quickly being realized, because it wasn't simply Black and Brown voters in majority minority districts that faced this challenge. It was Republican suburban communities. It was Republican rural communities. When you break it, when you use the rules to try to block legitimate voters, eventually the malfeasance and the incompetence will actually affect everyone. And so the challenge is that when we decide to eschew the responsibility of making sure that democracy works for everyone, eventually it can work for no one. And that's why we should be wary. That's why we should be fighting back. Because elections are not partisan. The selections we make are. But the act of casting a ballot should not be a partisan issue.
My guest is Stacey Abrams. The name of her new book is Our Time Is Now. And Stacey, you spent a lot of time in the book talking about history of voting rights in the United States and giving historical context. And it was just very interesting to read that, given what's all going on around us now in the United States and around the world, all these conversations about systemic racism. And one of the things that you say a lot, which I think is interesting, is you say you just can't fix problems, you have to fix whole systems. And we've been having these conversations about systems. When you think about, if you pull all the way out, when you think about a piece of legislation or an action that could lead the way for repairing systemic racism, I'll put the big one out, what is something you think about?
It sounds naive, but voting, ensuring access, full access to democracy for eligible voters is that solution, or at least the beginning of that solution. When communities legitimately feel that their votes count and that their voices can have an impact, it changes things. It's why we see the consistency of the protests that are happening right now, because people are aware that politicians are listening and are scrambling to be responsive. But what happens in our society, what has happened for time immemorial, is that the communities that had the greatest need have had the least access and the least amount of power. H.R. 1, which passed in the very first year of this congressional term, will create baseline access to democracy, automatic registration, same-day registration. It would restrict some of the more egregious rules that states have been allowed to put in play. And what it does is it lets people know that, yes, it's worth trying to elect people who can represent your interest. It is not there's no magic pill to solving systemic racism. In fact, the systemic part of that racism is so deep and so concretized that we can't undo in a decade what has been built up over 240 years, but we have the responsibility to try. And that's why I wrote the New York Times op-ed saying, I know voting feels like an inadequate response, but it is one of the few powers we hold in a democracy. It's one of the few ways we can push back. But it's also why the work I'm doing on the census is so critical. At the top, you mentioned that I'm working in Georgia, but we're actually working across the country, particularly across most southern states that are under-resourced for the census. Because the census is how we allocate not only economic power through the distribution of $1.5 trillion, but it's how we allocate political power, not only Congress and our state legislatures, but our school boards. And the rampant racism that we see play out in the distribution of resources and of power begins with how we construct our notion of what America looks like, and that happens through the census.
I'm going to ask you one more question because people know you have this other gig as a writer. Your pen name is Selena Montgomery, and you know publishing has had this reckoning with the way white authors are often paid more than people of color. There was that hashtag circulating, publishing paid me. Roxane Gay shared that she was just given a $12,000 advance for her first book, $15,000 for her second. Did you have that kind of experience in publishing? What was your first advance?
My first advance was $2,500.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. The advance for this book, did it help you pay off your debt?
It did indeed.
I won't ask you.
As I put it, my first advance helped me pay a car note. My most recent advance could help me buy a car.
That was my conversation with Stacey Abrams. She was here in June to talk about her book, Our Time Is Now.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.